From coast to coast to coast, you're listening to Terra Informa. I'm Tasmia Nishat, and I'll be your host for this next hour of assorted environmental news from across Canada and around the world. By the way, if you were wondering what that third coast is in our usual from coast to coast to coast intro, it's the northern coast. I know I was wondering that when I first started volunteering for Terra Informa. Sorry, northern coasters. This brings me to another point. Terra Informa is entirely volunteer-run, as are many other shows on CGSR, where we are produced. We rely on donations from folks such as yourselves to keep us going. FunDrive, CGSR's annual fundraising campaign, is going on this September 24th to October 4th. And if you pledge during our live show on September 30, you can even win some cool prizes. Anyway, I bet you're wondering what stories we have in store for you. This week, we use our time turners to look back at an archive piece about how the magic of a young wizard and his animal friends inspire people to get closer to real-life wildlife. But first, we talk the US's long-awaited decision on climate change. In the last few weeks, everyone's attention seems to be on US President Obama and his big plan. Does he have a plan, or doesn't he? The world is waiting. That particular plan is about the American decision to re-enter the war in Iraq. However, 9 months ago, it was a completely different plan that we were all holding our breath over. Back then, the plan, or lack thereof, had to do with climate change. It had been almost 4 years since his ambitious cap-and-trade bill died on the Senate. 4 years since the talk but no walk at the Copenhagen Climate Summit. And the decision on Keystone XL had been delayed a number of times. In June 2014, the White House had finally made a big climate announcement. And with the UN aiming for a major international climate agreement in 2015, there could be more on the way this year. Today we're looking at the plan for tackling climate change that US President Obama released earlier this summer. Here's more with Trevor Chow Fraser.
June 2nd, 2014. Matthew Iglesias, writing for Vox.com, called it the biggest day of US President Barack Obama's second term, the day he finally unveiled his plan for taking action on climate change. Well, actually, it is Obama's second plan. His first plan was much more ambitious, but it went nowhere. To understand America's new climate plan, we have to understand what happened the first time around. So let's just wind back the clock. Okay. In 2009, Obama's first year in office, the United Nations was moving into a crucial round of climate talks. The conference in Copenhagen was meant to solidify a deal to replace the Kyoto Accord. China and the US were supposed to come on board for the first time. Instead, the talks fell apart. The US, China, and a handful of others signed a non-binding document which set non-binding targets, and everyone went home unhappy. Meanwhile, the Democrats had put together a law that would have created a carbon trading market in the US. This so-called cap-and-trade system would have put a price on carbon and provided a way to gradually reduce emissions throughout the economy. In the US, bills need to pass a vote in both the House and the Senate. The cap-and-trade passed in the House, but then in 2010, it was killed in the Senate. This, despite Democrats holding a majority of the Senate. It seems many of them were unwilling to alienate voters dependent on the coal, gas, and oil industry. So that was it. No more climate change legislation for Barack Obama. Well, let's bring this forward to 2014. By now, the cap-and-trade bill was only one of many defeats Obama has seen in Congress. When the government itself shuts down for weeks because Congress won't pay the bills, well, it seems that it will be impossible for anything to become law these days. Earlier this year, I spoke with Mae Stevens, an environmentalist and policy advisor working on Capitol Hill. In our conversation, she explained the president's strategy for dealing with this situation. From here on in, he'll try to do as much as possible without needing to enact new laws. Instead, he will take a regulatory approach.
So why is America doing this, doing it in the regulatory way instead of legislation, is really because there's no possible way that legislation can move through Congress. And any sort of comprehensive climate bill is just not going to pass this Congress, which is, you know, a disaster only because we don't have much time left and we're actually like hitting tipping points already and we really need to do something about it. But you know, for right now and for the next year until the elections in 2014, there's really no possibility for that to move. So I think, you know, so that's why we're sort of, you know, that's why the president's pursuing a sort of regulatory approach, because he knows that Congress isn't going to act. You know, regulating the sort of new coal-fired power plants and existing coal-fired power plants were two things that they, you know, are on their agenda, and that's really important to them. But those are things that they don't need Congress to do, but they're also not super politically popular, so they wouldn't go through the House and the Senate. The House is controlled by Republicans, and a lot of the key committees are controlled by people who are climate deniers, so that's also really difficult to navigate around when, like, the House Science Committee is run by somebody who doesn't believe in climate change. Then it's very hard to move stuff and actually, like, even just have, like, an intellectual, honest debate about what we should do, right?
Now, I just want to clarify what we're talking about here. Putting a tax on carbon or setting up an emissions market would require a new law to be passed. The U.S. president, well, they're the leader of the country, they can't pass laws. Those have to be passed by Congress, by the members of the House and the Senate. Obama can put pressure on Congress to pass certain laws, but he can't go over their heads and enact the laws himself. Without new laws, all the president can do is work with the institutions that already exist. In other words, he can tell government agencies, like the Environmental Protection Agency, the EPA, to enforce new, stronger regulations.
So for the administration to do anything, they have to be, you know, there has to be a law that says that they're allowed to do it. And then they can promulgate regulations that say, you know, we're going to cut back on this, that, and the other thing, right? So, for example, when they look at the Clean Air Act, it says you can regulate pollutants that harm people's health. And so they said, well, carbon harms people's health, so we're going to regulate that under the Clean Air Act. And so they're looking at... coal-fired power plants, right? And they've done one round of regulations on coal-fired power plants, and now they're in the process of doing another round, right? So that's the administration can do that, and it doesn't need we don't need Congress to do it. But they can't do anything that Congress doesn't write a law and pass and tell the administration to do. That's why we're the legislative branch and they're the executive branch, because they execute stuff. So for, you know, really massive, like a cap and trade program, right? That couldn't be done by the administration. They could do, you know, other stuff. They could do smaller stuff, but they can't do those sort of big things.
So in short, Obama is stuck with these so-called smaller things, things like EPA regulations. But without the Clean Air Act and the EPA, he might not have anything to do at all. Since new environmental regulations are seemingly all the president is able, or perhaps willing, to achieve, let's take a look at what the EPA is planning to do to regulate greenhouse gas emissions and take action on climate change.
You're listening to Terra Informa on your local community radio station, or online at terrainforma.ca. Today, we're looking at the plan for tackling climate change that U.S. President Obama released earlier this summer. Here's more with Trevor Chow-Fraser.
Okay, before moving on, you might be wondering why any of this matters to you here in Canada. Well, it is important because our conservative government has explicitly aligned itself with American climate policy. They've gone so far as to withdraw from international commitments like the Kyoto Protocol because it would have differentiated Canada from the US too much. Michael Chong, Conservative MP from Ontario, explained to us last fall the government's approach to climate policy.
Well, I think there's two different ways to price carbon. One is to take a regulatory approach, and one is to put in place a carbon tax. In the case of Alberta, they've set up a climate change management corporation, which has put a price on carbon. The federal government has decided to take a different approach to this, and its approach has been to harmonize our approach with that of the United States, our largest trading partner, and I think that's a smart approach. We also have to be pragmatic about which of the two approaches we take. The reality is that we live in an integrated North American economy. The United States is clearly going down the path of a regulatory approach to reducing emissions, and I think it would harm the Canadian economy to take a different approach. So I support the regulatory approach because I think to not go down that path would negatively impact our trading relationship with the United States.
So far, Canada has replicated Obama's regulatory approach step for step. So with that in mind, here's what the U.S. announced earlier this summer. On June 2nd, the EPA issued a draft plan to regulate greenhouse gas emissions from all power plants in the USA. If their predictions are correct, and the draft is not watered down over the next year, this plan would reduce greenhouse gas emissions from power plants by 30% as compared to 2005 levels in the next half decade. Since power plants produce about a third of all U.S. emissions, this is a significant measure. According to Andrew Friedman's write-up on Mashable, there are 600 coal-fired power plants in America. They produce a third of U.S. electricity, but account for 75% of the sector's greenhouse gas emissions. One third of the production, three quarters of the emissions. So, driving these coal plants out of the picture would be a big step forward. The draft plan is complicated because it's actually 50 different plans. The EPA has set targets for each individual state. They've evaluated a state's current reliance on coal, their capacity to switch to renewables, and other factors to come up with what they consider to be a reasonable target. These vary wildly from state to state. Washington is being asked to cut back by 72%. But to accomplish that, it simply has to go ahead with its current plan to close the massive Centralia coal-fired power plant in the 2020s. Hawaii, Maine, and North Dakota, on the other hand, have been given targets closer to 15%. But that might be actually much harder for them to achieve, depending on their current reliance on coal. The EPA will leave it up to each state to choose the best way to take action. Options include finding efficiencies at coal plants, switching to natural gas or renewables, or even nuclear, or joining an emissions marketplace, basically a regional cap and trade system. Now, there's one big caveat for this plan, but you might have missed it if you only saw the headlines. The EPA is measuring intensity of emissions. So if the economy grows too much, states could hit their intensity targets, but still fail to cut overall emissions. Under the EPA regulations, this won't be a problem that can be addressed. These new regulations for existing power plants, if implemented, will be the strongest plank in Obama's climate plan. Other regulations have already been implemented successfully. There are new fuel economy standards for cars and light trucks. Large industrial facilities like refineries and cement factories, factories that emit more than 100,000 tons of CO2 per year, are now permitted by the EPA and are required to adopt leading emissions reduction technology. And the construction of new coal-fired power plants has basically been made impossible. Emission limits have been put in place that coal can basically never meet, while modern natural gas plants can. And finally, new regulations are on the way for landfills, which release a frightening amount of methane, as well as regulations for common refrigerants, which are also highly potent greenhouse gases. So you throw all those things together, and, well, that's it. That's the big plan. Is it enough? Well, certainly not. It's not enough to hit the target in the Copenhagen Accord, 17% reduction by 2020. Is it just a start, though? Well, we'll have to see. Even these small steps will be challenged in court, and it's possible that the EPA could be seen to be overreaching its powers. Even if it goes ahead, there will have to be more coming down the line. I asked Mae Stevens if there was any hope of new legislation on climate change in America at all.
I think the president realizes that there are stuff that just needs to get done that just can't be done on a sort of broad-based, you know, he just wouldn't have the broad political support for it. But I don't think that it's sort of exclusively going to be regulatory. I think there are a lot of people who would like to do a lot of good work in the House and the Senate. For example, there's a very big energy efficiency bill that was in the Senate that was bipartisan, so that had a big opportunity to go forward. Then energy efficiency, I think, is sort of the sort of unsexy cousin to the energy and environment movement, but it's one of the very lowest hanging fruits. It's good for a lot of reasons on a lot of levels as well, because it's really good for people who are low income, people, especially people of color who are, facing environmental justice issues in their neighborhoods. Like these are really good for a lot of people for reasons that sort of have nothing to do with the environment, right? Like you don't have to care about the environment to want your energy bill to go down. And I think that's really, it's a smart way of handling it in a political environment such as this, is that if you want to make change, then you have to broaden your base a lot. And I think that we've seen that sort of strategy thinking back to CAFE standards, where we've it's a corporate average fuel economy standards for cars, is what we call it in America. I'm sure you guys have a different acronym in Canada. But we looked at increasing the fuel economy for cars in America, and we got environmental groups and labor unions and the executives of the big three car companies to all sit down together and agree to really good fuel economy standards to be phased in. And it was a really good move for us, but that was because we really broadened the base quite a bit, and we're not only working with the sort of single issue voters on environment, right? Because there are a lot of, there are a lot of people that are members of labor unions who don't believe in climate change, but they're all for increasing CAFE standards because it means more cars are being produced and their fuel costs are going down. And, there are lots of other reasons to care about the environment. I think we're seeing that more and more. So that's sort of the strategy that we're going to go on in the House and the Senate.
This interview with Mae Stevens took place earlier this year, and I really have to admire her optimism. A bipartisan, broad-based approach does seem like the only way to get new climate legislation going in the United States. Unfortunately, experience is proving her wrong. That energy efficiency bill, well, it ended up dying in Senate this past May. With that in mind, it seems that anyone looking for U.S. leadership on climate change we'll have to keep watching the EPA for new regulations. Small steps, but ones that might possibly add up to something significant in time.
Thanks to Trevor Chow Fraser for that look at America's climate plans. Special thanks to Mae Stevens for sharing her insights with us. Hey listeners, do you want to give us a piece of your mind? Tweet it out at Terra Informa. Hopefully the piece of your mind is positive, but we welcome all feedback. Even if you haven't read J.K. Rowling's Harry Potter books, you've probably heard of Gryffindor, Voldemort, and Quidditch. Harry Potter has been an integral part of many a childhood and is entrenched in our pop culture consciousness. Some of the most iconic images from the books and the movie adaptations have spilled out into the real world. In Edmonton, a group of Harry Potter fans have taken their passion for the books and turned it into a way to support literacy, youth emergency services, and wildlife rehabilitation. Chris Chang-Yan Phillips hopped on his broomstick and traveled to one of their events at Edmonton Stanley Milner Public Library. He was curious about how a powerful story can inspire and distort our relationship with wildlife.
So they need these for hunting and kind of figuring everything out. Their ears are huge, and they're actually kind of off-center, I guess, so that they can kind of figure out sounds in a different dimension. Just go with the feathers.
No, I was. I think I pushed her off a little bit.
So my name is Carly Lynch, and I'm the Executive Support and Education Coordinator at the Wildlife Rehabilitation Society of Edmonton. We take care of injured, orphaned, sick, or contaminated wild animals, and we just care for them until they're healthy enough to be released, and that's our whole goal with every single animal we get in, is to release it back into its natural habitat. Colonel Slade was actually a wild owl, and she was brought into a rehabilitation center, but she wasn't actually able to be released. So she lives with a biologist out in Sherwood Park, and he brings her to presentations everywhere. She's done more presentations than I have. She goes all the time. She is a barred owl, and I'm actually not sure how she was injured. I know she is blind in one eye, and that's part of the reason why she can't be released, because they need to be able to see animals, to be able to hunt them. She's super calm, super tame, and she's really good for kind of showing people a wild animal in a safe environment.
And the theme, I guess, that brought her to this particular event was
Harry Potter and owls and how they connect together, which is really easy to kind of think of right off the bat.
If you saw this owl, you would guess that it's Draco Malfoy. It's kind of evil looking and nice and sleek too, just like the Malfoy family. So that's the Malfoy's owl. It is called a Eurasian eagle owl. They were actually hunted to extinction in Europe, which is kind of interesting.
Okay, so my name is Andrea, and I'm the project coordinator for Project Hedwig. It's a group connected to Potter Watch, but it's also its own little group as well. Potter Watch basically just finds charities around our community, and we use Harry Potter as sort of a front to give back. So for this one, we're using owls from the books as well for giving back. Well, I grew up with Harry Potter, so I've always loved it, and that's how actually Potter Watch hooked me into joining the group. And then once there, I saw all the good that they were doing, and I saw how much of an impact the community we had on the community. And we're not even a year old yet as a group, and we've already done so much. So it's always really exciting.
What are some of the other things you've done?
Well, the first project they did was Accio Books. So they got a bunch of books around the community or around the city and gave back. I think we got 6,000 or 7,000 books or something like that. We're also having a Yule Ball coming up in January. So that's going to the Youth Emergency Shelter.
And of course, I have to know, what house would you be?
I'm Hufflepuff.
Ooh, Hufflepuff.
Yes, I've been sorted. I had a little bit of trouble accepting it at first, but now I've accepted it.
People. You know a lot about Harry Potter, it seems like. Is that personal interest or professional interest, or what's the balance?
100% personal interest.
Do you watch the movies going like, oh yeah, that's exactly what Snowy Owl would?
Now I do. Before I didn't, really know too much about owls, but as my interest for them grew as I kept on watching the movies, yeah, definitely I'll look at an owl and be like, oh, that's a great gray owl, or oh, that's a Eurasian eagle owl or something. And yeah, now my bird nerd part comes to my Harry Potter nerd section. Owls in general are very, very smart. So you can see that in Hedwig. She knows where to go. I mean, obviously, if you just hand a letter to a wild owl, they won't know where you're wanting it to go. So that's the magical part of it. But they're very smart. They'll be able to fly back to their home territories if we release them relatively close to it. They know where that is. They're able to hunt like animals that are under snow. They're super intelligent, and they're kind of loyal to their families and their mates, and that kind of shows how Hedwig was loyal to Harry.
And now there's this effect that I've two effects that I've heard about from people reading the books and kind of being curious about owls. And one was that a lot of people adopted owls, and then another one was that people gave them up or abandoned them. Has that happened? And can you tell me a little about the factors that kind of led to that trend?
Yeah, so when you see in the movies that the owls are great pets, I guess, and great companions for the people, you kind of hope that that's something that you can have too, because, I mean, you want to be in that world. You want that to happen in real life to you. But if you take a wild animal out of the wild, they're not going to be happy with you. So lots of the time, if they were able to somehow catch a wild owl and bring it and try to have it as a pet, they would be terrible pets. They'd be pecking at you all the time, very stressed out, just really unhappy. And so that's when they just kind of sent them back out again after they were probably not as healthy, very stressed out, and it could be really dangerous for them back in the wild after they've been taken and not cared for properly. We do get some people that come in, they're like, oh, well, if you can't release this bird, can I keep it as a pet? But that's illegal. You can't actually hold on to a wild animal in your house and care for it unless you have the right permits for rehabilitation and care and stuff.
And I think the flip side of that is that you got a big audience out, and the partnership with the TELUS World of Science and the Harry Potter exhibit means that people are really interested in owls because of the books. What do those two things tell you about the power of stories to connect people to wildlife?
Even just like seemingly minor sections of a book, like about an owl bringing a letter, just like makes people more interested in that specific animal if they care for the book so much. So it'll make them want to do research, want to come to presentations like this and learn more about it. And I think that's really good for the species that people will mention throughout books, because it'll help with awareness and people will figure out the real issues and figure out I shouldn't have that as a pet and figure out what to do if they see a wild animal or something like that. So I think it really helps with people's awareness.
Do you think the effect is usually more people learning deeply about it and not just that casual curiosity that would lead someone to bring a dangerous bird into their house?
I'd like to think so, but I mean, if someone just kind of is like, oh, sweet, owls are awesome, I'll just take one, they might not actually care as deeply for that creature as other people. Even they just like the idea of it. Colonel Slade.
She is just so gorgeous and soft and alive. It's, I mean, really just having a wild creature. I mean, it's sad that she's in a bad situation, or that, not she's in a bad situation, but that she's injured and can't be in the wild, but it's great to be able to interact with a wild animal and remember the greatness of, you know, the animal world, you know, that we're not really a part of all the time. So, yeah, it's beautiful. She's so beautiful.
That was Chris Changyan Phillips learning about the owls of J.K. Rowling's world and Edmonton at the Stanley Milner Public Library. Thanks to Andrea Gway Colpitz from Potterwatch and Carly Lynch from Wildlife Rehabilitation Society of Edmonton. That's all the stories we've got for this week. But if you'd like to take part in an environmental activity possibly going on around you, here's what's happening. If you're into botany and positive vibes, check out this September 18th herb walk going down in London, Ontario, 7 p.m. at the Living Centre. These herb walks introduce wildcrafting, plant lore, botanical pharmacology, and recipes for teas and edible wild foods. On the same day, and same province, but in Ottawa, the penultimate installment of the City of Ottawa Wildlife Speaker Series this year will take place at Ben Franklin Place from 7 p.m. to 9 p.m. The star of this talk will be the white-tailed deer. The series is intended to increase residents' knowledge and appreciation of wildlife and promote coexistence through understanding and respect. This event is free of charge. Do you ever wonder about the evolution of animal complexity on a genetic basis? And will you be in Edmonton on Thursday, September 18th? If so, check out the talk being given by Dr. Mark Martindale in CCIS in Room 1-160 at 4 p.m. Given the advances of genomic sequencing, fascinating new questions in the field of evolutionary biology have arisen. For more information on all these cool events, check out terrainforma.ca. And that's all the time we've got. Thanks to our contributors Trevor Chow Fraser and Chris Changyan Phillips. Thanks also to Trevor for producing this thing, and I took care of website and coordination. Yeah, we Terra Informers are a multitasking bunch. FunDrive, our fundraising campaign, is happening September 24th to October 4th, and be sure to check out our live show on September 30th. Terra Informa is a production of CJSR 88.5 in Edmonton. I've been your host, Thasmi Anishat, and I'll catch you next week.